Good afternoon and welcome to Power for the People here on Solar Power WERU FM 89.9 in Blue Hill and in Bangor and everywhere in our solar system at WERU.org. I'm your host, Steve Cowell. As regular listeners know, Power for the People is all about information to empower citizens to take control of energy in their homes and in their lives. And just last month, we covered the new Maine Building Code, which was a modest step in Maine to building buildings that require less energy and provide guidance for the construction industry. We've touched in this on this program about a better way to reduce energy use and to reduce impact on the climate and probably to reduce maintenance costs even, is to exceed the building codes. And my guest today specializes in that. I think I can foreshadow that right there. So Timothy Locke is a management partner of Opal Architects, an architectural firm in Belfast that specializes in high efficiency buildings nationally, not just in the state of Maine. Timothy's signature line on his email has these three descriptors: architecture, innovation, and ecology, all of which are, of course, music to my ears after a career as a researcher and a professor focusing on environmental science, stormwater management, modern stormwater management, I might add, and renewable energy. Timothy works for Opal Architects. The Opal website describes Timothy as an architect, educator, and advocate leader in ecological design, whose work advances a more resilient built environment. And boy, that's certainly what we need in my mind. Welcome, Timothy.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So take a moment to expand a bit on that bulleted introduction by giving listeners an overview of your career, if you will. Mm-hmm. And also a philosophy of Opal Architects. And after that, I will ask that you give a few example projects. So sure. You can just give the overview of your career and of Opal.
Yeah, sure. So unique within our practice, within Opal, I actually grew up in Maine, actually only a few miles from WERU Studios in Ellsworth, mm-hmm. Maine, on the Orland-Ellsworth border. And I like to think that there was something about being the child of back to the landers moving from suburban New York City to rural Maine and being brought up in the background of Acadia National Park and all of the beautiful outdoor spaces that we get to enjoy in coastal Maine that kind of seeped in there about that kind of rural edge condition that Maine is, that our buildings have to mitigate. And that when I went off to architecture school, went to Syracuse University School of Architecture, and then eventually started practicing in New York City, that some of that nascent ecological understanding from my childhood stuck there. And as I started to practice, started to realize more and more that the impact of buildings, the impact of the designs that we create as architects had a much more broad potential responsibility to our stakeholders and to the sites and the planet that they sit within than maybe we were acknowledging. And that I started to kind of look to other models, ways of designing that could potentially maybe yield more positive impacts than that. And even before I relocated from New York back to Maine to join then Geologic and eventually Opal, it had been something that I was already kind of kicking the tires on internally in my work and wanting to see architecture is an avenue for just better ecological outcomes in general, particularly our own human ecology. I think the one thing that we don't really think about a lot, even those of us that are kind of deep within climate action or other types of sustainable design pursuits, is that we spend more than 80% of our lives inside buildings. And for most of us living on this planet, the buildings that we inhabit are the single greatest ecological artifacts that we create or have, because they're the things that actually allow us to survive in many parts of the world, including Maine. We couldn't live here given the harshness of the climate without buildings. And so why don't we take that as an opportunity to use design as a way to make them impacts, sorry, vehicles for change, for positive impact, rather than necessary evils to overcome. And so aligning with a firm like Geologic at the time, and eventually with the kind of transition to Opal, to embracing the true impact across not just energy, but carbon emissions, the resources we extract, the sites and the ecosystems that we become part of with the buildings we design. Do you want me to retake that because of the phone?
No, go.
Really wanted to seek to kind of leverage that opportunity as much as we possibly could. Maine seemed like the right place to do that. We're on this, again, on this edge condition. We have this history of resilient architecture going back 400 years of colonial habitation, and even before that, if we look at the indigenous communities that populated the state, and understanding of how to build resourceful buildings, build less, build more in tune with the climate and environment, already exists in Maine. And to be able to practice architecture in that space and then potentially spread that ethos, that process, that view of design as a vehicle out to projects in other parts of the country has just been a pleasure. And to be able to expand the practice to kind of really drive a design canon and process that focuses on that has been truly rewarding.
Well, welcome back to the state. Much belatedly, I too left twice and came back twice for very similar reasons, and so glad to have you back. So I did notice that your own home is a passive house. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of that and the performance of that.
So when my wife and I bought land in outside of Camden, Maine, and designed a house, I think it's always a treat and not always something that you get to do as an architect, getting to design your own home. We kind of naturally gravitated towards a passive house because it was core to what we do in our practice. And we wanted to see, if it's good enough for our clients, it should be good enough for us. So let's give it a shot. And we've now lived there for 9 years. We moved in 2016. On average, I currently spend about, oh, I'd say $200, $150 to $200 a year to heat our house. We, at the time, designed it to use essentially one load of firewood a year. We don't have any other heating in the house. Sorry, one load of firewood a day. So I make one fire a day in the winter. That's all of the heating or cooling we do in the house year round. So usually we can keep the house heated with a half a quart of wood a year. And that's gone up in price. And maybe if I was to do it now, I might consider a different fuel source. But at the time, it was really trying to consider how could you truly hyper mile a house if you were the one designing it and living in it. So we used all of the normal passive house principles that we're using on our clients' buildings at the time. We also, because I was the designer of it, were able to kind of think critically, even in the early days, about total resource use, embodied emissions and the resources we use, and design a building to just simply use less material as well, focusing on design decisions like small foundations that reduce concrete, lack of interior walls, more open space to reduce the amount of even biogenic materials like wood studs. We can reduce the quantity of those, made it cheaper for us too to build, which was great at the time. But these were kind of early days of us even considering those things 10 years ago. And now they've really become core to the practice, not just the energy used in a passive house. And for your listeners, a passive house, requires you to use 80% less energy than a code compliant building on average. So you're not necessarily trying to attack the problem in terms of production of energy. You're trying to first just use as little as possible. So starting to expand that model into materials as well, thinking about siting, thinking about being careful about how much what we call human-only space that we kind of carve out of a site, being sensitive to habitats that exists where we don't even necessarily realize it, and avoid things like giant lawns and stuff like that. So all of those are things we got to kind of pressure test on our own little project. Now, I can't say that all of them were always successful in real life. Certainly the energy use, the passive house component, the lack of intensive use of materials were great. Do we sometimes wish we had an extra door we could close? Yeah, that's everyday life. But I think generally, for our family, we felt like it was a huge success. We love our house.
So, a passive house, you've described it here for the listeners, and hopefully everybody has a general sense of what they're all about. One thing I think that people miss is that a passive house, and you've just described how you've got less infrastructure, HVAC infrastructure, for example, than the average home. I mean, you can build a leaky house and install a gigantic natural gas heating plant. That's going to cost you money forever versus paying some additional money up front. Can you, without getting into serious numbers, can you give a general guidance for somebody who might be thinking about building something new and the cost differences between passive and leaky?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that you hit on it, Steve. The thing that a lot of people miss is that it sounds, when you think about it, you think about a passive house and you learn, well, this thing needs to use at least 80% less energy than a code compliant house. Well, you must need to put a lot of expensive things into that to make sure that happens. And some of that is a little bit true. You have to build a thicker wall, you have to put in better windows, you have to make sure it's not drafty by air sealing the walls and the roof and the foundation. But I like to think about that in terms of us living in Maine. If we go outside in the winter in Maine, all of us who live here know that you better put on a reasonable jacket and you better zip it up. And so all we're asking our building to do is wear the proper jacket for the climate that it sits in. Because if you don't, what happens is you have to put in a giant heating system that not only is crazy expensive to run, but you also have to repair constantly because it's running all the time. So it's a twofold benefit. It's like, yes, you put more money into the jacket itself, but putting money into the jacket itself means you don't have to run all the time to keep yourself warm in the winter. Because we know if we were to do that as humans, eventually our body's going to break down. You just can't. And essentially, that's what we've been making our heating systems do for the last 100 years is, well, we're going to leave it to the heating system to fix this problem. And then we're not going to remember that this was a choice 10 years later when the thing's breaking down, or we need to call a mechanic every winter to get it cleaned out and started up. And so it's not just the first costs of having a significantly smaller heating system, which certainly defer most of that cost of the envelope, but it's also not having any of the maintenance. It's like, and that more and more, especially in a rural state like Maine, speaks to the resiliency of passive houses. So people think about resiliency and they think about things like coastal flooding or fires or things or those types of more extreme weather events. Resiliency is also the reality that we don't have the service pool that we once did. We don't have necessarily, with an aging population, you might not have necessarily the ability to do things yourself, to fix things yourself. So that's allowing a building to be more resilient and spend less money over time. So more and more, I think we're seeing that ROI get paid back, that ROI on spending the extra money on the jacket get paid back even more rapidly than we originally thought. At first, we were looking at 7, 8 years, but once we start considering maintenance as well, it can be even shorter than that. And we see that to be a benefit. And if you get to larger buildings, sometimes there isn't even an ROI. Sometimes the first cost of a passive house is cheaper because those mechanical systems represent such a significant portion of the initial cost of construction. We learned that as we started getting into bigger institutional academic buildings about 10 years ago with colleges and universities, and then with other small kind of aligned institutions around New England. that once we kind of crested 10, 15,000 square feet, even the initial cost of the building, despite the good jacket, were just straight up cheaper with a passive house because those mechanical systems were so much simpler. You didn't need extensive controls, automation, things like that. Suddenly all that went away. And I'm really intrigued by that going forward because we do have this resiliency issue with maintenance and service. And I think that's starting to become more and more what people are talking about the benefits of passive house, even more so just than the fuel costs themselves, which are also substantially lower.
Right, and one of the things you talk about is social impact in terms of education on the things we're talking about here. And I have to admit, it's bugged me for at least 15 years when I see a new school being proposed, a public school being proposed, and they are not talking about renewable energy or passive house construction. And that's where the kids are going to learn, and the teachers, and it's going to trickle down to their parents the advantages that you're talking about here. So there's no question about that. So and I do just want to mention here something that I do mention from time to time. Even if you're not in a passive house, if your oil boiler fails, what do? You call up the oil boiler repair man, and he says, "Here's give me $12,000, and I'll put a new one in," rather than calling up the heat pump guy. And so we're in this trap of continuing to do the things that we understand how to do. And I will just add here, and this is taking away perhaps a little bit from your focus on new construction, but I live in a 1948 house that I retrofitted, and my total energy bill is this coming year will be about $350. The previous owner spent $4,000, and it hasn't been phenomenally expensive to do it. I've taken advantage of efficiency main rebates. We have had efficiency main staff on here probably once a year. There are ways to do this stuff that just makes sense. Well, so thank you for your comment about your own home. I think your website refers to a family of Opal Industries, is Timber HP out of Ingham, and we have covered Timber HP on this program, led by a co-founder of Opal, in fact, Matt O'Malley. They have taken the Madison closed paper mill and are making timber insulation, something that's been common in Europe for decades, and it's the first time we've been using it in the U.S. Tell me about your how are you using Timber HP insulation in your projects?
So, because there is this alignment with not only Timber HP, but there's also a mass timber and timber insulation prefabrication company, Notch SB, which is in Belfast as well, which we co-own. What we've found in the adoption of these kind of more radical and more progressive approaches to ecological building design is that sometimes you bump against availability of materials or installation methods in maybe a rural environment or maybe just domestically in general, because other parts of the world might be more technologically advanced in some of those approaches. And so timber insulation is one of those. You know, it's a product that's existed in Europe for quite some time, but it's disadvantaged there because the forestry industry does not produce as much residual waste as we do in parts of New England, for instance.
Yeah, we have trees that they don't have, and yet they're ahead of us on that
Exactly.
one.
Yep. And not only that, but we have the residuals to spare that used to go to paper production, now less so because we don't use as much of that product. And so the ability to kind of just press that material far less and make something that can hold air within it and therefore become insulation is a huge opportunity. And the reason we look at that is that as we start to reduce the amount of energy that buildings need through passive house design and other types of strategies, and as an industry as a whole, as a culture, start to produce more energy without fossil fuel production through renewable resources, we see the impact of energy use become, although it's still the majority of the emissions in the building sector, it gets less and less and less every year. and the impact of the emissions that go into the materials we use start to take up more of that share. And so we need to start focusing on not just using more insulation and making a better jacket, but what is that jacket made of, and what are the emissions that went into making those products. And so we love things that potentially can store emissions. So a tree is soaking up carbon dioxide when it's growing, and then it's holding that as solid carbon inside it. And the same is the case with that same mass of wood chips that become insulation. So the more we can trap that stored carbon inside buildings for long periods of time, because the lifespan of buildings is long, it helps us significantly reduce the impact of the resources alongside still making that good jacket to reduce the energy use. So it allows us to do both at the same time. So products like that are huge. The other big one that's exciting to a lot of people in my discipline right now in architecture is mass timber, because that's taking tiny little bits of solid wood, gluing it together to essentially do the same thing that you can do with steel and concrete, materials that don't store any solid carbon. And so if you can start doing that with the structure, which is the highest mass component of the building, and the envelope, which is your good jacket, through something like Timber HP, then you really have something that you can start getting close to a pathway to a truly carbon neutral building, not just carbon neutral in its operations, but in its construction as well. And that's the dream. There aren't any, if we really measure everything, those buildings don't exist yet, but all these steps are a pathway towards getting to that. It was something that I had the pleasure of leading a small group on and advising the Biden-Harris administration on for 2 years, which of course, given the change in administration, has stopped. But it was exciting to start to work with colleagues across the country and even internationally. And this is a small subset of people that actually measure and track this information, to be like, is there a horizon where we could be actually talking about buildings that don't emit at all over their lifespan? And the answer is yes, that is probably going to be possible within our lifetime. And it's exciting to be part of figuring out as a designer how you get there.
Well, I'm interested that you brought that up, because I did see that on your bio that you'd worked with the Biden administration, probably relating to some of the legislation that was passed during that time. I'm not sure how to ask the question, but I mean, what impact will the current political climate have on your industry, renewable energy, whatever you feel comfortable commenting on there?
Yeah, I mean, I would still say, and people might be surprised to hear this, but I think it's still hard to say at this point. I think that there's always going to need to be a vanguard of designers that are working beyond code, to reference what you'd said to lead off the interview anyway, and we will continue to do that. Us at Opal are in that group. What we've found is that usually, what we've seen over time is that the success and notoriety of the vanguard is enough to kind of belay some of the, let's call it, the floor of what's acceptable. And I think what we've seen erode in the last 9 months is the floor. But I think that floor had risen a lot higher than we even know yet. What people see as acceptable for their house, if it's designed custom or a renovation in your case, for their institutional buildings, school buildings, civic buildings, is quite a bit higher than where we were in 2016, where we were in 2010. And I have a lot of faith in that floor, and that people's demands of their buildings is what designers are ultimately responding to. And if you can set an expectation that's really high, and that's possible, and show it through case studies, and show it through, say, friends of the of a client that's embarking on this process for the first time and are a little scared, then that's a huge step forward. Those real world examples I've found matter more than somebody in a government building in Washington, D.C. saying, "Oh, now that's not okay anymore. That's not cool by me anymore." I do think there is real impact in the subsidies, some of the subsidies going away. But I would love everybody to learn a little bit about just using less. So even if it's energy, you can make a lot more money over time by simply using less energy than the rebate on building a big solar array would ever be, even under the Biden administration. So I'd lean into that and say, you can still make your money back very quickly. Yes, you won't get this big one-time rebate, but that rebate's one time. What we're talking about is designing a resilient future for your lifespan and beyond, because buildings last a long time. And that's an easy thing to show, even with numbers, even with costs. And so I have a lot of faith in that, because those strategies have been normalized now. It's not like we're back in 2010 and have to prove it again. These buildings exist all over the state. A lot of people have been in them without even knowing. And a lot of people ask, can I get some heat pumps, even when they're not maybe politically aligned with me? And so I think there's saturation that we don't even necessarily realize. And so maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I think that, people always want to reach for that positive impact more than the negative outcome.
And I mean, certainly, there are aspects where it's all about profits for oil companies, but I think there's a lot of other entities out there that I'm seeing in my internet feed and discussion with people that are along the lines of what you're saying as well. No question. So we're down to under 2 minutes. Give people a quickie on how to reach Opal Architects, the type of things that you're doing for people in Eastern Maine who are listening to this program. And again, a minute and a half at most.
Yeah, so we are a architectural services and design firm, and advocacy and consulting firm in Belfast, Maine. You can reach us at opalarch.us. We design what we think are some of the most ecologically positive buildings in North America, across a whole range of different uses, from single family housing, renovation and new construction, all the way to large higher ed academic buildings and anything in between. What we bring to it is a relentless approach to being climate positive, and bring those positive solutions to our customers, to our clients. So please feel free to reach out. We take projects of all scales, and we're happy to work with you if you'd be excited to hear how that can benefit you.
Well, thanks so much, Tim. I certainly applaud the type of things that you guys are doing and your philosophies. So you've been listening to Power for the People here on WERU FM 89.9 in Blue Hill and 89.9 in Bangor, with guest Timothy Locke of Opal Architects, as he just described, how you can get in touch with them if you are interested. Power for the People airs the fourth Friday in the public affairs time slot at 4:30 p.m. So join us next time to learn more about energy topics, policies, technology, and solutions for your life. Thanks very much. Thank you, Timothy. And we'll see listeners, or your listeners, next month. Thanks very much.